Succession number 19914, Reel 2.
Colonel Henderson, Reel 2.
And the Australians went forward and, in a magnificent action, 2.317 and the hinge, and consolidated themselves on these two features. And with that, 28 Brigade's task in Operation Commando was complete, and we had taken these three features, and the Chinese had been driven off them. Now, shortly after the 4th of October, my battalion, 1KOSB, 1st Battalion, 1K, 1st Battalion, the King's Own Scottish Borders, was ordered forward to take over from the Australians on point 317, a feature called the Knoll and the Hinge, which, as I've explained, had been taken by the Australians on the 5th, 6th and 7th of October. Shortly after the 7th, we were moved from point 355 and we took over from the Australians on these three features.
Before you go any further, if I can just go back to the capture of 355 and ask you about it in more detail, please. You said that you were lying up before the assault. What were conditions like as you were lying up?
Before actually attacking it?
Yes.
Well, they were much the same as any situation in Korea. One had to dig in wherever you were, because if you did not, you would suffer enormously from Chinese mortar fire, which was constantly going on. And wherever you were, whatever you were preparing to do, you dug trenches and you grabbed whatever sleep you could do, could take, by living in these trenches. And you slept in the bottom of a slip trench with guards out from your own platoon, a certain number, approximately one man sleeping, I beg your pardon, one man on guard, two men sleeping, and taking it in turn to do a stint on duty. And one just slept in one's trenches at the bottom of the hill, ready to move forward the following morning.
And would all the people in your platoon know what was going to happen?
Oh, yes. Roddy Robertson MacLeod, who was commanding D Company, would have been briefed by the commanding officer. He, Roddy Robertson MacLeod, would then brief his own platoon commanders. So we would be fully briefed on the night of the 3rd of October as to what had to happen on the following morning at first light. And at first light, we would be ready, having stood to. This is a term well known, I think, in military circles. Everybody stood to just before first light, and that meant that everybody in the platoon was ready in case of an attack from the enemy, the Chinese.
In what frame of mind were you just before the assault was launched?
I recollect that this was obviously a formidable task, but there's not a great deal of time to think about anything else except making sure that your traps are all ready to go, that your weapon is clean, that you're carrying the correct amount of ammunition, and that everything in your platoon works, and that everybody in your platoon knows what is expected of them.
What is the requisite amount of ammunition?
Each man carried his personal weapon and approximately 100 rounds of ammunition in bandoliers, which were tied either around your waist or over your shoulder. And then, of course, resupply and ammunition was very quickly available from one's colour sergeant, who came up if you expended more of your ammunition than you expected to.
Were you able to sleep before the assault?
I cannot, I'm afraid, remember whether one slept on the night of the 3rd, oblique 4th of October or not. I suspect not a lot, no.
And were there losses to your platoon as you assaulted the hill?
There were a small number of losses. Nobody was killed. Some of my platoon were wounded. And as far as losses on the far side, some Chinese were killed on point 355. The great majority escaped in spite of this amazing bombardment by artillery from the core guns. So the casualties were actually very small. One interesting thing happened on the night of the 4th, 5th of October, that is after we'd actually taken Point 355. We heard voices at night, and the following morning I spoke to my platoon sergeant, who was a chap called Sergeant Lancaster, and said somebody last night was chattering away at night. And did he have any idea who it was? He said, no, I too heard these noises, but we have no idea who was talking at night. Because, of course, at night you keep completely quiet. And it turned out that two Chinese had remained on the hill. They'd just not managed to get off when the bombardment started and when we arrived as soldiers on their feature. And after shouting down a very deep hole, these two young Chinese soldiers appeared, and I think I showed you a photograph of them as they came out of their trench.
From Mike Hickey's book.
From Michael Hickey's book on Korea, correct.
And when the assault was in progress, what did you do as a platoon commander? Do you lead from the front, or do you do something else, or what?
My recollection was that you are positioned in the middle of your platoon. In other words, you have a section on either side of you and probably a section behind you. And you just move up with the two sections and yourself in the middle in line. And you with your signaler and your orderly. And we just move forward up under the bombardment from the artillery fire onto the objective.
What were you armed with yourself?
I was actually armed with an American carbine. Many of us thought that the .303 rifle was rather a heavy weapon to carry. And there is an amusing aside here, because you could pick up an American carbine from the Americans very easily, and they would, for instance, exchange for a bottle of gin and their own carbines, which is unheard of in British Army circles, where nobody ever, ever gave up their weapon for anything. But the Americans would sell, in inverted commas, their weapon for a bottle of gin, which we had access to, and they, being Americans, were dry and did not have access to. But they were very happy to get a bottle of gin and would give you their carbines. I carried a carbine. The rifleman in my platoon, of course, all had the 303 Lee Enfield rifle.
What impression did the Chinese earthworks make on you when they were captured?
The Chinese were very clever at digging their trenches and burrowing underground, and as a result of that, their casualties were pretty small, in spite of the huge bombardment. They were amazing. They were really very much better diggers of trenches and underground defense positions than we were. And there is a further story, which I can tell you about in a moment, about their prowess at digging in and disappearing underground. You know, I think there is a very interesting fact in this, which is perhaps unknown to a great many politicians who have no idea what war is actually like. Not known to politicians, and I think this became very apparent during the recent Kosovo war, when I think a great many politicians thought that by bombing and smashing Kosovo to pieces, they would necessarily destroy the Serbian army. Now, in fact, this is not the case, because armies learn very quickly to dig themselves underground and so protect themselves from the effects of bombardments, however severe. And I remember being extremely skeptical in that particular war, that is the Kosovo war, that you could ever defeat the Serbs without actually using ground forces, which of course the politicians said they would not use originally, and that, in my view, prolonged the war enormously. In that particular war, i.e. Kosovo. But back to Korea, which is the war we are talking about. After the 1st Battalion of my regiment moved forward and took over from the Australians on point 317, a feature called the Knoll and the Hinge, the Australians went back into reserve in 28th Brigade. And so we were left on this difficult feature to defend, because point 317, like point 355, stuck out like a sore thumb. Now, we had known it as a sore thumb when we attacked 313.355. The Australians had known that it stuck out like a sore thumb when they took 317. And, of course, the Chinese were then in the opposite position. They could see this feature, and they could hammer it day and night with mortars and their own artillery fire. So when we moved onto this ridge, 317, next to it, a thing called the Knoll, and then on its left, that is towards the west, the Hinge, we had our battalion placed on this very difficult feature to defend. And my company, D Company, was allocated the defense of point 317 and the Knoll. The Knoll was quite a large feature. I was one of the platoons from D Company allocated to the Knoll, and C Company, which was on our left, had its right-hand platoon on the Knoll. So you had facing north, you had D Company and point 317 with one platoon, which was my platoon, on the Knoll, and on the Hinge you had C Company with its right-hand platoon on the Knoll. So on the Knoll, which is the next part of my story, you had my platoon commanded by myself, and also on the same feature, you had a platoon of Charlie Company commanded by somebody called William Purvis, who I will perhaps have the opportunity of talking about in a moment as I relate my story. So, by mid-October, it would be true to say that we were firm on this feature, point 317, the Knoll and the Hinge. And during the next fortnight leading up to the end of October in 1951, we dug in and did all the things that we'd learned to do in Hong Kong in the previous year. Dig in, lay wire, fields of fire, secret routes in and out of our positions, tracks up which the Korean porters could come with our resupply. We learned the importance of sticking to the reverse slopes. We learned the importance of keeping out of sight. We learned the importance of digging in underground, and achieved this on all three positions before the end of October 1951. Now, the interesting thing about these three features that I've talked about is that 317 was very much a sore thumb and very difficult to disappear in, i.e. the camouflage on that feature was not at all good. The Knoll, where we were, and I was with my platoon, and William Purvis was with his platoon, was quite different, because there was an enormous amount of undergrowth on that, and we were able to move around on that feature, lay wire amongst the trees, and be, to all intents and purposes, invisible on that feature. The Hinge was rather like 317. It was exposed and not easy to defend. So you had these three features. The middle one, which was the one I was on with William Purvis, was easy to defend because it had this amazing amount of undergrowth on it, which had miraculously remained. Now, at the beginning of November, a lot of very interesting things started to happen. The Chinese put up a huge board, and one morning we saw it from the Knoll, and on the board, which must have been, I don't know, 400 or 500 yards away, I suppose, but through binoculars, perfectly capable of reading the message on it, it said, Britishers, leave these hills or they will become your graves. And we all thought this was very amusing. And the 1st of November passed, the 2nd of November passed. And then on the 4th of November, it was quite obvious that there were huge movements of Chinese troops into the valley below us. And on the night of the 4th, 5th, we could hear an enormous amount of digging taking place. And on the morning of the 5th, when we wake up, it was quite clear that the Chinese had dug a trench from the hill's opposite Hinge down into the low ground underneath Hinge. And on the morning of the 5th, we literally saw once again through binoculars the Chinese moving down this trench and disappearing in the valley below. And so we knew trouble was brewing. And the battle which ensued on the day of the 5th of November, which was subsequently called the Guy Fawkes Battle, the Chinese attacked the Hinge, point 317, and the Knoll. And throughout that day, they bombarded these features and the features behind us back towards our A echelon and battalion headquarters. And we existed in our little platoon or company positions, not knowing what on earth was going on to our left or to our right. Telephones, of course, which in those days were operated by cable, had been smashed to pieces. In the case of William Purvis and my, our radios no longer worked, and we did not know by nightfall on the 5th what on earth was happening on either our left at Hinge or on our right, point 317. Neither he was in touch with his company commander, nor I with my company commander, Roddy Roberts MacLeod, who I've mentioned before. And the night proceeded. We were attacked by Chinese. But in our case on Knoll, because we had been in a position to lay out so much wire, and because we had this marvelous undergrowth all around us, the Chinese never actually managed to get onto the Knoll. Unknown to us, D Company on point 317 and C Company on Hinge had been forced back off these two features by the Chinese weight and numbers. Now, at about 5 o'clock on the morning of the 5th, the 6th of November by this time, the 6th of November, either mine or William Purvis's radio came to life, and we were able to pick up battalion headquarters, and battalion headquarters asked the position we were in, and we told them where we were and that we were still on the Knoll. And at that stage, we were ordered back off the Knoll to go back to battalion headquarters. I had been wounded during that night, and I had been given morphia, or I'd given myself morphia, I can't remember which, but I was not absolutely compos mentis, and William Purvis took over both my platoon and his own.
And what's where had you been wounded?
I had been shot through the left arm and hit by shrapnel in my right arm and in my face. And as I have explained, I was not compos mentis. And William Purvis took over both platoons. And he then behaved most heroically and extracted both platoons from the Knoll, complete with all their equipment and all members of both platoons who had not been killed, and some had, and returned this force of two platoons back to battalion headquarters. I don't know if you'd like to hear a little more about William Purvis, or perhaps there is somebody you'd like to speak to yourself. But he did extremely well. And I think I owe my life, and I think a lot of the two platoons i.e. mine from D Company and his from C Company, owe their lives to the way in which he behaved and extracted us from this position. And he was, in fact, rewarded by being awarded the Distinguished Service Order for his actions that night on the Knoll. William Purvis, as you perhaps know, has gone on to be a most brilliant banker and chairman of the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank and so on, and has remained a very great friend of mine throughout our lives. So these were the two large battles in which I was involved in that action in Korea in October and November with my battalion.
What kind of treatment did you get for your wounds?
I was casualty evacuated from my own platoon position, which I've just talked about, once William Purvis got us out of this feature we were on, to what was known as the regimental aid post, where the MO of the battalion was. And from there I was patched up, and I was then casualty back to a field hospital where I was operated on, and then I was casualty back to Japan, where there were proper hospital facilities in a place called Kyore in Japan. I was then sent to a rehabilitation center in the inland sea of Japan, and eventually I was casualty back to Hong Kong and back to the United Kingdom.
Going back to the Guy Fawkes battle, can you give any other incidents, any details of what you recollect about it as witnessed by yourself?
Yes. On the night of the 5th of November, as darkness approached, I think I've already said that all the whole thing, the chaos ensued, and we did not know what was happening on our left or our right flank. And so we were concerned only with this feature and the two platoon positions. We were undoubtedly being mortared, and the Chinese themselves couldn't get through the wire which we'd put up, so there was no question of hand-to-hand fighting on that feature, because they just could not get at us because of the luck we had had from the undergrowth which covered this feature. And because we'd had very nearly 3 weeks there, we were able to put down a most massive amount of wire, so it would have been very difficult for any enemy to actually get through the wire to our positions and our trenches, which of course were dug in behind the wire. You may be interested in how on earth did you ever get out of that mass of wire, and the answer was we had little secret passages which we all knew about, and on the reverse side of the slope, out of which we could move easily in the event of us having to leave, and that is indeed what eventually happened. But the Chinese did not actually get onto that feature while we were there because of the luck we had had from the undergrowth and the trees into which we were able to twine masses and masses of barbed wire. The night itself was a night of keeping one's head down whenever you heard the mortar shells coming. I do recollect at one stage that the ammunition piles we had went on fire, and we had to put those out. I remember that our 5-gallon water cans, the water jerry cans from which we had our water, were punctured, and there was no water left. It was pretty good chaos. And of course on that particular night everybody was awake and ready throughout the night, dealing with the Chinese assault on our feature, which, as I have said, the Chinese did not actually reach us because they could not get through our wire. But of course we had fields of fire, fixed fields of fire, down which we fired. And from a Chinese point of view, I think it was an extremely difficult task to take the Knoll. But because we had been lucky in the position we had been actually put into, had we been on 317 or Hinge, the position would have not been half as easy, because both stuck out like sore thumbs and were very easy to assault.
What opinion did you form of the Chinese soldier?
I had high regard for the Chinese soldier. The Chinese soldier was very interesting and so different to ourselves, whereas every single person in our army was armed. The Chinese soldier in 1951 was very often not armed and merely moved forward with a few members of his subunit who were armed. They wore very ordinary, thin uniforms. They carried their food with them, which invariably was merely a bag of rice. They wore sort of rubber trainer-type shoes. They all carried digging implements so that they could very quickly dig in. They were a peasant army, and they were extremely, extremely tough. I have the highest regard for the Chinese army.
So did that mean that was the end of the Korean War for you?
That was the end of the Korean War for me, yes.
Whilst you were in Korea, did the political aspect of the war mean anything at all to you?
I recollect that it did, because of course it was, I think, pretty clear from about October of 1951 that there was a situation of stalemate. In spite of the fact that the Chinese had entered the war, the United Nations were extremely strong along the line of the Imjin River and along the 38th parallel, which was the parallel straight across the Korean Peninsula, at which stage the United Nations held firm. And yes, we were aware that there were tremendous movements to try to produce peace and some form of stabilization in Korea, which, as I think we both know, eventually ensued in about 1953. But from 1951, October, November 1951, through till 1953, when peace was eventually signed, it was a static, totally static war, trench warfare, with small features no doubt being taken, small features no doubt being retaken by the opposite side, trench warfare, and of course the severe winter, which I personally escaped, because the winter started in late November and went on, of course, December, January, February. I personally escaped that, but it, I know, was extremely unpleasant for those who had to remain, because Korea consists of an extreme climate. In the summer, it is extremely hot. In the winter, it is extremely cold.
How do you feel now about having served with the KOSB in Korea?
Well, I'm just... I'm very proud of what happened and what the Bataan managed to do. And I have the deepest of respect for my brother officers and everybody who took part in it and the soldiers of the battalion.
Did you experience any later active service?
Yes. After the Korean War was over, my battalion was sent to Malaya in 1955, where we took part in the war against the Chinese terrorists in Malaya. We were stationed in Johor, which is the most southern state of Malaya, and the battalion was there during 1955, 56, and 57. My next experience on active service with the battalion was in Aden, where we took part in the demise of Aden, really, and the handing over of Aden